KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump blames Ukraine for standing in the way of a peace deal because it won't let Russia keep control over Crimea. What's the administration asking of Russia? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump also wants to use his, quote, secret weapon to fight what he calls ideological bias at colleges and universities. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. He's trying to overhaul how schools get approved to receive federal financial aid. And SpaceX wants to turn its company town in Texas into the city of Starbase. It is Thursday, April 24th. On this day in 1800, President John Adams agreed to spend $5,000 to buy books for lawmakers, creating what would become the largest library in the world, the Library of Congress. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is scolding Russian President Vladimir Putin. Russia bombed Ukraine's capital last night, killing at least eight people in Kyiv and wounding more than 70 others. Writing online, Trump says, quote, Vladimir, stop. Trump says, quote, let's get the peace deal done. Earlier today, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had just arrived for his first official visit to South Africa when Russia bombed Ukraine. He has now cut short his visit to return home. Speaking through an interpreter before he left, Zelensky called for more attention to Russia's actions.
I don't see much pressure on Russia or any new strong sanctions packages against the Russian aggression for now. We're very hopeful, and this is not an accusation. We're saying this very directly and without any emotion. We believe that if more pressure were applied to Russia, we'll be able to make our positions closer.
He was heard on the BBC. A federal judge is giving the Trump administration another week to provide details about the illegal deportation of a man from the U.S. to El Salvador. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, the reprieve comes a day after the judge accused the administration of flouting her order.
Federal District Judge Paul Azzini's had ordered the Trump administration to explain what it's doing to seek the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia to the U.S. In a scathing order on Tuesday, Zinis accused the Trump administration of, quote, willful and bad faith refusal to comply with her instructions. In response, the Justice Department filed a sealed motion requesting a stay for 7 days, and Judge Zinis agreed to extend the deadline for a week. The Trump administration has conceded that Abrego Garcia was deported last month because of an administrative error, but has argued it cannot bring him back because he is in the custody of El Salvador. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
China is rejecting claims that there are any trade talks underway between Beijing and the U.S. Yesterday, President Trump said the two countries were talking every day. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the National Association of Realtors reported a slowdown in home sales last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials fell about 3 points in early trading.
Spring is ordinarily a busy time for buying and selling houses, but not with mortgage rates near 7%. The combination of high borrowing costs and high prices is keeping homes out of reach for many would-be buyers. The Realtors Association says sales of existing homes were down almost 6% last month. The average selling price continues to climb, however. Last month it was just under $404,000. A flurry of new orders for airplanes caused a spike in durable goods orders last month. The Commerce Department says orders for long-lasting manufactured goods jumped a whopping 9.2% in March. Stripping out airplanes and other transportation equipment, durable goods orders were flat. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Prosecutors in New Jersey have charged a man with arson in connection with a big wildfire that's now burned more than 13,000 acres. It's half contained. New Jersey officials allege 19-year-old Joseph Kling set wooden pallets on fire and then walked away. The blaze is still so large, air quality alerts have been posted today for New York City. Drug maker Eli Lilly, the producer of the popular obesity drug Zepbound, is suing telehealth companies that sell alternative versions called compounded drugs. Compounding pharmacies are allowed to make what are essentially copies of brand-name drugs during shortages. But NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports those shortages are over.
For 2 years, compounding pharmacies have filled the gap for patients who were unable to get Eli Lilly's Zepbound for obesity or Mounjaro for type 2 diabetes due to drug shortages. They also afforded access to the drugs for patients whose insurance didn't cover them by selling them for cheaper. But now that the FDA has declared the shortages over, making these very close copies is no longer allowed. Lilly is suing 4 telehealth companies selling compounded versions: Mochi Health, Henry Meds, Fella and Delilah Health, and Willow Health. The companies did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says that Iran must give up all of its programs to enrich nuclear material if it wants to secure a deal with the Trump administration. Rubio spoke during an interview with the online publication The Free Press. Iran insists that its nuclear enrichment program is for peaceful purposes. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics with On Swift Horses, starring Daisy Edgar Jones and Jacob Elordi. A married woman explores a secret love upon the arrival of her brother-in-law, who gambles on his own hidden romance. Starts Friday in theaters.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Sirens and the crackle of Ukraine's air defenses filled the skies of Kyiv last night as Russia launched another wave of attacks.
This morning, President Trump told Russian leader Vladimir Putin to, quote, stop. In a social media post, Trump said the Russian strikes were not necessary and very bad timing. But Trump is also pressuring Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky to accept a U.S.-backed peace deal or risk, in Trump's words, losing the country to Russia.
We wanted to get a view on how these developments are seen in Russia, so we're joined by NPR's Charles Maines from Moscow. Charles, good morning.
Morning.
So once again, we've seen President Trump really lay into Ukraine, and Zelensky in particular, saying he is blocking a peace deal. So tell us more about this, and how is it being seen in Moscow?
Well, I think it's important to point out the White House has yet to publicly offer specifics on this peace plan, but it's clear it heavily favors Russia on paper. J.D. Vance said this deal would lock in the current front lines or something close to it. But the latest dust-up with Ukraine involves Zelensky's refusal to acknowledge the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia took from Ukraine in 2014, as now formally part of Russia. This is apparently a component of this U.S. peace deal and a non-starter for Ukraine. You know, as to Russia's reaction, the Kremlin only said it welcomed American negotiation efforts, which, by the way, pick up again this week when White House envoy Steve Witkoff heads to Moscow.
You know, one of the criticisms of Trump's approach to negotiations is that it does appear so one-sided. Trump seems to be asking a lot of Ukraine and so little of Russia. Why is that?
Well, Trump seems to say he wants peace now, and he clearly sees leverage over Kyiv as the quickest way to get there. I recently met with Sergei Plertayev. He's the founder of a political and security platform, Vot4, in Russia. And he argues Trump isn't offering Moscow concessions, rather acknowledging the facts on the ground. Let's listen.
Это то, что Россия обеспечила
So here Politkayev says this is what Russia secured through battle, what it gained by force, not anything Trump, quote, gave us. And Politkayev, I think, reflects a common view here in Russia that there's not a whole lot Trump can do to change the current battlefield dynamics unless Trump is willing to get more involved in Ukraine. And based on everything he's done and said, that looks very, very unlikely.
And the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said the U.S. would walk away from peace talks if they don't see progress. Would Russia want that?
Not entirely, because in Moscow's eyes, Trump can deliver some things quicker through diplomacy than Moscow can achieve militarily, which is why I think you see Putin offering proposals like this recent Easter Day ceasefire or possible direct talks with Ukraine to stop attacks on civilians. You know, is that real progress? Probably most would say no. But Russia's continuing its attacks, and also it's shown almost no flexibility in the actual negotiations towards ending the war.
Plus, it does seem that Trump has ceded to most of Russia's demands, including a ban on NATO membership for Ukraine. So why isn't Moscow jumping at that offer?
Because they want more, you know, including a change of leadership in Kyiv, perhaps with U.S. backing. So Moscow is happy to amplify White House frustrations with Zelensky. You know, Putin's other approach here has been to expand negotiations. You know, he's inflexible on Ukraine, but extremely flexible when it comes to other deals with the U.S., whether that's investment opportunities, prisoner exchanges, even helping with negotiations with Iran. So Putin is making himself very useful to Trump and making it very hard to walk away. You know, think of it as Putin's own version of the art of the deal.
Oh, how about that? That is NPR's Charles Mainz. Charles, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
As the administration pushes Ukraine for a deal, President Trump has signed a sweeping list of executive actions targeting higher education and K-12 schools.
They include proposals to eliminate DEI programs at colleges and new discipline guidance for public schools.
NPR's Alyssa Nadworny is with us now with more details. Good morning, Alyssa.
Good morning.
So what do these executive actions do?
Well, let me tell you about two of the higher education orders. So the first deals with college accreditation and directs the Secretary of Education to, quote, overhaul the system. Now, accreditation is the process colleges are required to go through to receive federal financial aid. It's aimed at ensuring that a program meets an acceptable level of quality. And Trump has referred to accreditation on the campaign trail as his, quote, secret weapon in his effort to combat what he considers ideological bias in higher education. Here's White House Staff Secretary Will Scharf.
The basic idea is to force accreditation to be focused on the merit and the actual results that these universities are providing, as opposed to how woke these universities have gotten.
And what's the second?
Well, it relates to colleges disclosing foreign gifts. So it essentially says that federal grants for universities could be revoked if schools do not complete full and timely disclosure of foreign funding. Now, federal law already requires schools to disclose gifts or contracts worth $250,000 or more from foreign entities. The new order doesn't provide specific thresholds or new rules, but it instead asserts that universities provide, quote, the American people with greater access to general information about foreign funding.
So, Alyssa, you've been following this showdown between the administration and selective colleges like Harvard. How does this action fit into that?
Yeah, so in a briefing announcing the order, Scharf actually called out Harvard specifically.
We believe that certain universities, including, for example, Harvard, have routinely violated this law, and this law has not been effectively enforced.
Harvard says it has followed federal law. But this order essentially gives the administration the ability to cut off federal funds from schools that do not disclose the money they receive from foreign entities. So you take these two together, and the administration is trying to create ways to hold colleges accountable for ideological overreach and to increase intellectual diversity on campus.
What they consider ideological overreach.
Exactly.
So that's higher ed. What about K-12?
Basically, Trump requested new federal guidance on school discipline. The measure calls for revoking previous policies by Presidents Joe Biden and Barack Obama aimed at reducing racial disparities in, for example, suspensions and expulsions. And the new guidance would prohibit using, quote, racially preferential discipline policies.
So once again, centering the administration's view of DEI, what about the other orders?
So the other executive actions focus on things like bolstering workforce training, improving artificial intelligence in schools, and launching a new White House initiative on historically Black colleges and universities. The collection of orders aim to cement Trump's conservative agenda when it comes to education in America, rolling back policies from the Biden administration, and putting in place additional levers that they can pull when colleges don't follow the policy agendas they have set forth.
That is NPR's Alyssa Nadworny. Alyssa, thank you.
You bet.
Ksenia Petrova is a Russian biology researcher at Harvard Medical School. Petrova was traveling back to the United States from France a couple of months ago and was carrying samples of frog embryos for her research. Now that caught the attention of customs at Logan Airport. Petrova's visa was revoked and she's been in detention ever since. Her Harvard colleague, Leon Peshkin, has been keeping in contact with her.
She's a scientist by God, I would say. She comes from the same training that at some point I went through myself, an elite high school in Russia. Those are the kind of people for whom only one thing matters in life, science. We want to understand how things work and find cures.
Yeah, and she had a passion for what she was doing. I mean, she really loved it.
Yes, she. When we connected, she told me she couldn't see a way forward for herself in Russia, continuing to do science. And she dreamt specifically to do the kind of science which I was planning to do, looking at biological system at single cell level. So she says until she got arrested, she was in paradise and she wants to come back to this paradise.
So what is your understanding about why she was detained?
I think the picture is very clear. There was a slight misunderstanding at the border of what she was supposed to do with some of the samples she was bringing in. This triggered her visa being canceled. She ended up being in the country without valid visa because of a border officer mistake and was about to be sent out of the country. They asked her, should we call the Russian embassy? She's a citizen of Russia. She said, oh God, no, please don't. I'm afraid to go back to Russia. And that triggered her asylum case.
She has protested the war in Ukraine, and that is a punishable offense in Russia. So I'm wondering, at this point, how much is she thinking about that as a possibility?
All I know is that she is extremely scared of this possibility. She expects to be prosecuted if she returns to Russia.
Do you know how other researchers who are in the country on scholar visas are reacting to this?
Yes, there are many people on visas around who are just depressed. First of all, it's extremely important for a scientist to be able to travel freely. And now they would be worried every time they cross the border. It's important to travel for conferences, to see colleagues, to learn, disseminate science. So many people wouldn't be able to normally do their work. But more than that, people who came here to contribute are now thinking of leaving, of looking for jobs elsewhere. So I think it's going to have a large negative impact when people are intimidated, scared, no longer interested to come.
How hopeful are you that this will be resolved in a way where Ksenia gets to stay in the United States?
I'm sorry to say, but I'm not very hopeful. It seems like no one understands the rules. It's not at all clear who is in charge, who makes the judgment, what is being done, and why. So I think, unfortunately, the chances of her coming back are slim.
Leon Peshkin is a biology research scientist at Harvard Medical School. Leon, thank you very much for sharing.
Thank you for having me.
We reached out to Customs and Border Protection to ask why Petrova's visa was revoked. We were referred to an April 22nd post on X by Tricia McLaughlin, Department of Homeland Security Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs. And she wrote that Petrova, quote, lied to federal officers about carrying substances into the country. She added that messages found on her phone revealed she had planned to smuggle the materials through customs without declaring them. This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, the mystery of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. While millions of Americans have the diagnosis and are treated with stimulants, there is no scientific consensus about the biological roots of the condition and some medical concerns about common treatments. We'll talk about the latest research with journalist Paul Tuff. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From EBSCO, providing researchers with access to biomedical and healthcare literature reviews with the goal of helping them conduct thorough reviews in less time. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The SpaceX rocket launch site in South Texas has grown a lot lately. New facilities, homes for workers, a second launch pad. Now it's trying to turn from company town to bona fide city. Voters will soon decide whether to incorporate the area as the city of Starbase. If approved, SpaceX CEO Elon Musk also wants more control of the nearby public beach. The Texas Newsroom's Lauren Magahi has this report.
Boca Chica Beach is for everyone. On any given day, you can find people fishing its waters, camping next to its dunes, or biking along its surf. Sandwiched between the border with Mexico and South Padre Island, Boca Chica is a public beach, open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's because of a very special Texas thing.
Texas, our Texas.
Voters enshrined the right to public beaches in the Texas Constitution, going further than other states to guarantee access to the beach up to the vegetation line. Keith Reynolds has lived here for decades. The water is the reason he moved here.
I thought I was doing so good getting away from civilization and all the idiots.
But recently, Keith, and anyone else who lives nearby, hasn't been able to visit the beach as much as usual. That's because just up the road is SpaceX's Starbase, Elon Musk's massive rocket launch facility. Starship, the rocket eventually meant to ferry humans to Mars, takes off from here. Every time SpaceX tests a rocket, county officials order the entire area to be cleared. But now, SpaceX wants more control over the public beach. To get that control, first, the area around SpaceX would need to be incorporated as its own city. Then, the new city's leaders would have to convince the state to hand them control over beach closures. Seem like a tall ask? Not for Elon Musk. The effort is already underway. In less than a month, the few hundred residents who live around the site will vote on whether to create their own town, the city of Starbase. Keith says he's one of just a few eligible voters in the area who don't work for Musk, so he's not even planning to turn out for the Starbase election.
My vote's not going to count. It's not going to matter. Starbase is going to happen.
If the vote to create the city does pass, State Senator Adam Hinojosa wants to give Starbase the power to shutter the beach during the week. When lawmakers debated his bill earlier this month, Hinojosa brushed off concerns that he's handing control over a public beach to Starbase and SpaceX, and therefore to Elon Musk. Hinojosa said he only wants
to streamline that process and make it more efficient during those non-peak times. That's all we're doing. We're not allowing additional time for closures at all.
SpaceX did not respond to our request for an interview, but in a letter to state lawmakers, the company called the bill a simple administrative change that would kickstart the world's first private spaceport. The bill easily passed the Texas Senate and now heads to the House, but standing in its way is the top local official, Cameron County Judge Eddie Trevino. He said he's grateful that SpaceX invested here. After all, nearly one in four locals live in poverty. But Trevino says control over the beach needs to remain with him and other local county leaders.
So you're talking about changing the current authority of Cameron County and handing it over to a city that at this moment is non-existent with regards to the closure of a state highway and a state public beach.
All this is happening at a pivotal time. SpaceX is asking the FAA to increase from 5 to 25 launches a year.
If they didn't start having more launch, it was going to prevent or delay the possibility of getting back to the moon, and the moon is obviously the first step in getting to Mars.
So which side will win the battle for Boca Chica Beach? The local activists, the county officials, or one of the richest people in the world and his inexorable push to get to Mars? We'll find out more on May 3rd. For NPR, I'm Lauren McGaughey from Boca Chica Beach.
The number of children and teenagers behind bars in the U.S. hit historic lows during the pandemic, but the disparity between Black and American Indian kids and their white peers is the widest it's been in decades. Here's NPR criminal justice reporter Meg Anderson.
Jasmine Tai Ting Fong has seen firsthand kids get criminalized for just being kids, like a young child playing in a public park.
And someone thought that they damaged an item and the police coming and handcuffing all of the children.
She's a staff attorney at the ACLU of New Mexico. She says this sort of thing happens more often to Black boys and girls.
They're perceived to be older, to be less innocent. Girls are perceived, again, to be older and more sexualized.
Studies show children of color are treated more harshly in the justice system than their white peers. And federal data suggests that disparity is widening. In 2023, the most recent year for which data is available, Black children were nearly six times more likely to be incarcerated than white children. American Indian children were nearly four times more likely. Perry Moriarty, a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, says that's in part because youth incarceration rates are actually far lower than they were a few decades ago.
When we reduce incarceration overall, writ large, disparities often go up.
Certain policies have helped reduce the youth detention population, like diversion programs. And juvenile justice experts say kids today also just commit fewer crimes than they used to. But Moriarty says for the kids who do get locked up,
what you would often hear is, we've now finally got the kids who need to be there.
And those kids, the ones that police, prosecutors, and judges decide need to be there, are disproportionately children of color.
The kids who remain are often the kids with more complex needs. They are kids we could reach in other ways. And the reality is, we've chosen not to.
Those children are staying in detention longer, too. That's according to Nate Bayless, who heads the Juvenile Justice Strategy Group at the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Youth are being released more slowly from detention, and Black youth are being released much more slowly from detention once they've been detained.
That can have lasting consequences.
The longer young people stay in detention, the less likely they are to, for example, enroll in school, far less likely to ever graduate. More likely to be rearrested than young people who are not detained. They're more likely to be involved in the adult system when they get older.
Bayless says juvenile justice should be about responding to mistakes young people make by steering them toward a different path. Relying on detention, he says, makes it harder to do that. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Filmmaker Isaiah Saxon grew up exploring redwood forests and looking out for Sasquatch.
You think that you're seeing things and you think that you might be one step away from the great magical experience.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Isaiah Saxon has filmed The Legend of Ochi and the Magic of Nature on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is cutting short his visit to South Africa after Russia's latest missile and drone attack targeting Kyiv. It left more than a half dozen people dead and injured at least 70 others. China's foreign ministry is denying President Trump's assertion that the U.S. and Beijing have been discussing tariffs. This follows comments in recent days from the president and some of his top economic advisors that they expect to lower the 145% tariff placed on U.S. imports of Chinese goods. Here's NPR's Asma Khalid.
China is, of course, one of the U.S.'s biggest trading partners. The president told reporters this week that if his administration cannot reach a deal with China, they'll just set a number unilaterally, by which he means they will set a tariff rate on their own.
Separately, Democratic attorneys general in 12 states are suing President Trump, alleging it's illegal for the president to enact tariffs. The lawsuit argues only Congress has the power to do so. The states include Arizona, Colorado, Illinois, and New York. Authorities in New Jersey say a 19-year-old man is facing charges of arson in connection with a wildfire that's burned more than 13,000 acres. Joseph Kling is accused of failing to properly extinguish a bonfire that sparked the fire. This is NPR News. Elon Musk's social media platform X is suing to try to block a law in Minnesota that restricts the use of digitally altered videos, or deepfakes, to influence an election. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, Musk says the artificial intelligence regulation infringes on free speech.
Musk's lawsuit is attacking a Minnesota law passed to curb the misuse of AI-driven videos known as deepfakes. The state law holds social media platforms like X accountable for circulating manipulated videos that could be used to spread election misinformation. Musk's suit claims the law will result in wide swaths of political speech being censored and could make sites like X criminally liable for carrying deepfakes. The lawsuit names Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison as a defendant, accusing him of personal animus against Musk, including when Ellison called Musk a billionaire baby. More than 20 states have passed similar legislation regulating the use of deepfakes around elections. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Sales of previously owned homes in the U.S. slowed last month. The National Association of Realtors says sales fell almost 6% from February. It marked the sharpest monthly decline since November of 2022. This year's NFL draft takes place tonight in Green Bay, Wisconsin. The Tennessee Titans have the first pick. Stocks are higher on Wall Street. The Dow is up almost 200 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Thief River Falls is in northwestern Minnesota, and along with having a really cool name, is really small. But it grew a very big company that is now riding out an unprecedented and unpredictable storm, tariffs. NPR's Alina Selyuk takes us there.
The town rises among miles of rain-soaked wheat fields, striped with spruces and poplars, near the crossing of two rivers, a train track, with a towering grain elevator swarmed by birds. This is part of the town's origin story, lumber milling, then farming, and on its other end is its biggest employer of today, a high-tech warehouse. This is DigiKey, one of the world's biggest marketplaces for electronic components, kind of like Amazon, but for engineers who need resistors, capacitors, semiconductors.
It's like looking for clothes, but knowing there's really only one store on the planet that has all the varieties and styles and colors and sizes that you're looking for.
Dave Doherty is the president of DigiKey. Thief River Falls, a town of 8,800 people, is where it was founded in the early 70s, and it stayed.
We ship around the globe, but every additional shipment into China or into Germany or into Japan creates jobs in Thief River Falls.
But first, DigiKey's goods have to come to Thief River Falls, and that means tariffs. Terry Avernishin's job of trade compliance has gotten turbulent.
Oh my gosh, yes. Oh, I wake up in cold sweats about tariffs. I absolutely do.
Trump added 10% more on China, then another 10, then up to 145%. Then he tariffed all the world's imports, then he put that on pause, made separate plans for electronics and semiconductors.
The yo-yo effect that we're having, like it's on, it's off, it's on, it's off, this is in, this is out.
Avernishin now keeps a notepad by her bedside for midnight tariff math.
I'm up a lot of times at 2-3 in the morning because I just can't sleep.
Doing tariff math?
Because my head is constantly running.
Some of DigiKey's wares are made in America, but most parts travel the world. They might start here, make a pit stop in Malaysia or Taiwan. About a quarter arrive from China. At U.S. Customs, a supplier gets the tariff bill and often sends it right along to DigiKey.
We're currently at $500 million. So we're at $500 million is how much we have spent on tariffs.
That's since 2018. The company had found ways to cut those costs. It has set up a free trade zone. It can store some of its imports as if they never entered U.S. soil. And it could recoup some money through a government refund program for stuff it sells abroad. But many new tariffs no longer allow these refunds. And sometimes DigiKey is simply left holding the bag.
Customers are, some of them are just not paying the tariff.
Some just decide not to, others are not set up for it.
So their systems don't take the tariff.
So it's essentially an accounting software.
It's an accounting nightmare.
And more work for everyone. The online team built a toggle for the website so shoppers can see only non-tariffed items. Customer service reps trained on tariff questions. Orders that used to flow automatically to the warehouse now require humans to fix tariff errors. Inside DigiKey's warehouse, people who pack orders wear grounding strips on their shoes to avoid static. The tiniest parts require tweezers. Many are spooled on reels, so workers roll them out and cut them like ribbon at a fabric store. DigiKey employs half its county's workforce. It helps that DigiKey's neighbor is a big factory. It makes Arctic Hat snowmobiles. But snowmobiles don't sell like they used to, and the factory is slated to shut down.
So you've got a community now that just lost its one of his top two employers in the region, and now you have the surviving employer heavily hamstrung by these tariffs.
Tim Carroll is DigiKey's vice president of digital business.
So we're trying to figure out, how do you make sure you're doing right by the community that grew DigiKey up?
The company faces big questions. Can it pressure suppliers to eat more of the tariff costs? Manufacturers say they cannot afford it. So then how much can DigiKey absorb itself? Can it charge shoppers more without losing them? And an existential one, is it time for DigiKey to open warehouses outside the U.S.?
That's where other companies have gone. We have not.
President Dave Doherty.
We're the lifeblood of Northwest Minnesota.
A supplier visiting DigiKey from New Jersey gives me an analogy for this moment of tariff chaos. Imagine playing a football game, he says, but in a blizzard. The winner will be whoever is best at managing the stormy conditions. I think about this when I visit the river dam about a mile from DigiKey. Two 12-year-old boys are fishing after school. They're wearing Crocs while climbing through snowbanks, last remnants of winter. If anyone's used to weathering blizzards, perhaps it is northern Minnesotans. Alina Seluch, NPR News, Thief River Falls.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is vowing that the people behind an attack on tourists will be punished. In a speech Thursday, he said, quote, "We will pursue them to the ends of the earth." Most of the 26 killed in a scenic meadow in Indian-controlled Kashmir were Hindu men. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Mumbai.
And we should all be proud of him in every day.
A new bride, now a widow. She clung to the coffin that transported her slain husband, a naval officer, in a video shared by Indian news media. As family pulled her away, she saluted him. India quickly blamed Pakistan because the attack was claimed by a group that's seen as being backed by the Pakistani army. Pakistan denies any connection, but in India, the mood was for retaliation. Hindu nationalist protesters chanted death to Pakistan outside the country's embassy in New Delhi. Analysts on talk shows demanded war. Indian media anchors demanded action.
We've taken this nonsense for far too long. There has to be a red line.
India has so far expelled some Pakistani diplomats. It has shut down the lone border crossing, and it suspended a decades-old water treaty.
Until Pakistan credibly and irrevocably abjures its support for cross-border terrorism.
That means India may now build more dams on rivers that flow into Pakistan, a country that's deeply water-stressed. Many Pakistani officials, like Senator Mushahid Hussain, argued the militant attack was a pretext to deny Pakistan water.
Almost it is tantamount to aggression, water aggression.
Then Pakistan announced its own response, including a halt to all trade with India. It ordered the expulsion of some Indian diplomats and it shut its airspace to Indian flights. And it said, if India attempted to stop or divert water meant to reach Pakistan, it would be considered an act of war. But it stopped short of vowing a military response. Meanwhile, some Indian security analysts say India could be seen as treading softly. It hasn't used military force yet. This is retired Indian Colonel Ajay Shukla.
If we do sort of apply hard power, we will be in a position where we could escalate into a situation where war does not become impossible.
Where war does not become impossible. And a war, he says, that promises great risk to India. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
This is NPR News.
What drives Elon Musk? Historian Jill Lepore says, look to his grandfather, Joshua Haldeman, a leader of the technocracy movement. Next time, Here and Now.
NPR is on the radio, online, and at your fingertips, wherever you go. Stay connected. Take the news with you on your smartphone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. How much would you pay to watch a season of your favorite baseball team's games? $100? $200? A new streaming plan debuted this week for local Baltimore Orioles and Washington Nationals fans. It was supposed to cost about $90, but somebody forgot a decimal point and charged some would-be subscribers $9,000. Thankfully, they were refunded, so they'll have something left for their hot dogs. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. It has been decades since the NFL had a true two-way player, a guy who doesn't sit and take a breather while his teammates on the other side of the ball go out and play, but instead plays both offense and defense, kind of in the way that Shohei Ohtani hits and pitches. Well, tonight that could change in the first round of the NFL draft, where Colorado star and Heisman Trophy winner Travis Hunter is expected to be one of the first names called. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan joins us now. So, okay, the first question of the draft always has to be, who is going to be chosen first?
Yeah, well, you just did this whole setup about Travis Hunter, and I actually think he might not get taken first, even though I think he's sort of widely considered to be the best player in the draft. But in the NFL, quarterbacks are king. The Tennessee Titans have a first pick. They need a quarterback. And I really do think they're going to pick Cam Ward, the Miami, Florida quarterback, who is the sort of top prospect in this class, that kind of the only one who appears to be really genuinely ready to step onto an NFL team. Unlike so many of those top quarterbacks recently, Cam Ward wasn't, you know, a sort of highly touted recruit out of high school. There's this like 5-star rating system for high school recruits. Cam Ward had 0 stars. He started his college career at a sort of lower tier school, Incarnate Word, transferred to Washington State, and then finally for his final season transferred again to Miami. And now he's headed into the draft.
So, okay, what about Travis Hunter, the Heisman Trophy winner, the two-way player out of Colorado? Where might he land?
Yeah, I think he's probably going to go number two. I mean, Hunter, he played cornerback on defense, wide receiver on offense, and not just like a little bit of one or the other. He played the majority of the team's snaps, genuinely a feat in itself in big time college football. So like wide receiver, you're running hard every play. Most of those guys then get to sit and rest while the defense is on the field, but not Hunter, who went out and did it again as a cornerback. And he was very good at both positions. And so as a wide receiver, he had the 5th most receiving yards in the top level of college football, the 2nd most receiving touchdowns. And then as a defensive back, he had 4 interceptions. So just top tier play all around.
All right, but that's college, Becky. What about grown men in the NFL? How does that translate?
It's not clear. That's the big question. And, you know, sort of as you alluded to, the last time there was like a true full-time two-way player was before the Super Bowl era. This guy named Chuck Bednarik, who played with the Eagles as a linebacker and a center, starting in both of those positions. Then about 30 years ago, you had the Pro Bowl cornerback Deion Sanders, who spent a season playing wide receiver full-time. But these days, the most you'll see in the NFL is sort of like a defensive player who occasionally plays on offense, usually some sort of tricky end zone play. Hunter, however, is very unusual. His level of play in both of these positions is really unique. It's the Cleveland Browns who have the number 2 pick. Last week, their general manager, Andrew Berry, compared Hunter, as you did, to Ohtani. Let's listen.
That's a little bit like Ohtani, right? Where, you know, when he's playing one side, he's an outstanding player. If he's a pitcher, he's a hitter, he's an outstanding player. You obviously get a unicorn if you use him both ways.
So I think Hunter probably going to Cleveland. He could maybe slip to number 3 to the New York Giants, but it's hard to see him going any lower than that.
Yeah. Now, what else interests you about this draft?
I think the other sort of big thing is sort of like the return of the running back to prominence in the NFL. There had been for like the last 5+ years, this sort of new modern conventional wisdom that you shouldn't spend a high pick on running backs. Their careers are often shorter than other positions. They're relatively numerous, so kind of easier to replace. But the NFL, what's out of fashion now, always comes back into fashion again later. So here we have a lot of running backs in this class. Ashton Jeanty, I think, is the prize of them. He's the star at Boise State, who is neck and neck with Travis Hunter in the Heisman voting. I don't think he'll go as high as Hunter, obviously, but he could go in the top 10, which is really something for a running back these days. There's a lot of talk about how deep this running back class is, so I think we're going to see a lot of teams taking running backs this year.
NPR's Becky Sullivan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
We begin with people in the U.S. illegally who pay taxes.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Mercury. Mercury offers banking and financial software to help businesses do more in one place. Learn more at mercury.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The government has moved to give immigration officials access to IRS records. The Trump administration wants to use tax info to find people under deportation orders or who have committed crimes. This blurring of a traditional boundary is reportedly the reason one of the acting heads of the IRS quit the other day. Critics say this could cost the U.S. Treasury tens of billions of dollars in tax revenue if people see being in the tax system as a new liability, Marketplace's Nova Safo reports.
For the last 15 years, Itzel Ramirez, who runs a tax preparation service in Milwaukee, has helped clients stay current with the IRS by filing with ITINs, a special Social Security-like number the agency created for foreign nationals.
All the time I say, do your taxes. It's good for you.
The prevailing wisdom in immigrant communities has been that filing taxes can help efforts to remain in the U.S., at minimum by showing proof of residency and responsible behavior. But this tax season, Ramirez says she's processed about half as many filings as usual, hundreds less.
This year, the people say, no, I don't want it because maybe IRS shared information with ICE, or no, because for what I need to do that the government sent us to Mexico or sent us to our country. So they wait for these reasons.
Experts worry that the ICE-IRS data sharing pact will lead to unintended consequences just like this. And the costs to America's bottom line could be steep. Natasha Sarin is with the Yale Budget Lab.
Unauthorized immigrants pay about $66 billion in federal income and payroll taxes, and another about $30 billion in state taxes.
If more undocumented immigrants stop filing and begin working outside of the traditional payroll system, many use fake, borrowed, or stolen Social Security numbers, the annual gap between taxes owed and taxes paid could widen.
You're going to see a $25 billion increase, we estimate, in the tax gap.
Beyond economics, Michael Kircher of NYU's Tax Law Center says there's a humanitarian concern as well. IRS data simply is not designed for law enforcement purposes, and he's worried about false positives.
The IRS might confirm that somebody with a given name lives at a particular address, only for them to be an entirely unrelated person. But still end up sort of being detained because, for example, they have a common and similar name.
In addition, the IRS does not update addresses in real time between tax filings, so those could be wrong as well. Experts also question whether the Trump administration's data sharing plan is lawful in the first place.
It breaks a precedent that at least from 1976.
Nina Olson was the national taxpayer advocate and now heads the nonprofit Center for Taxpayer Rights. 1976 is when Congress passed a law explicitly limiting the sharing of taxpayer data.
Up until this year, the IRS's position had always been, we do not share information with, you know, ICE or DHS unless there is a specific investigation specific to that person going on and there has to be a court order requiring it.
The IRS did not provide us with an interview, but the Trump administration has said its data sharing plan is legal and limited to specific criminal cases. So far, there is no lawsuit challenging that claim. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve checks in with businesses region by region, and the resulting report, blandly called the Beige Book, finds a steady economy, but among warning signs uncovered, what is happening to tourism in the U.S.?
The tourism warning signs are sprinkled throughout the Beige Book, which includes anecdotes from the businesses around the 12 regional Fed banks. The Philadelphia, New York, and Boston Feds say tourism from Canada is down considerably. The Minneapolis Fed says a North Dakota retailer reported a deep impact from that, with first quarter revenues down 7%. The Atlanta Fed says airlines reported a notable decline in foreign passengers flying into the U.S. Earlier today, American Airlines withdrew its financial forecast for the year. The airline says it, quote, intends to provide a full year update as the economic outlook becomes clearer. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer
for Marketplace.
With all the uncertainty in trade and markets, there's news existing home sales took a dramatic tumble in March, down 5.9% nationally, almost double the drop expected. Prices were firmer in places where the number of houses on sale is low, including the Northeast. Markets, the Dow is up 252 points, 0.6%. The S&P up 1.2%. The NASDAQ up 1.7%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, dedicated to helping businesses save time on office tasks and empower leaders with business buying solutions that support teams to focus on growing the business. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
We have the power of time travel. Just say a Hasbro brand, Play-Doh, Nerf guns, Transformers, and there you are, age six. Well, there's news today. Hasbro increased its profits and is getting ready for more Star Wars sales. The stock is up 15% right now, but these results are for January through March, a quarter that ended before the new tariffs. Marketplace's Savannah Peters has more.
As many as 80% of the toys we buy in the U.S. are manufactured in China. Big players were shifting more production into countries like Vietnam and India even before the trade war, says independent toy industry analyst Chris Byrne.
The challenge with that is capacity, infrastructure, availability of labor, and the ability to do some of the more sophisticated manufacturing
that Chinese factories have been perfecting for decades. The trade war will likely speed up the shift to those other countries, but not in time to save the industry's busiest sales season.
Planning for this holiday season is absolute chaos right now.
James Zahn with the trade publication The Toy Book says American retailers have canceled orders, manufacturers have halted production in China, and shipments of finished toys aren't leaving the country since steep tariffs went into effect.
This is deja vu to the pandemic in the worst way. Every day you are stopped, that creates a several day ripple in the supply chain.
By Halloween, Zahn predicts we'll start to see much higher prices and empty shelves in the toy aisle. I'm Savannah Peters for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM American Public Media.